one-man revolution. A guerrilla scholar warrior. A renaissance man for the new dark age. Welcome to Prof. CJ's Dangerous History Podcast.
All right, last time we covered the background of who the large policy clique were around the turn of the century in the United States and what they wanted and how prior to the mid-1890s, they were really having a hard time getting their wish list of militarism and imperialism going. And now we're going to look at how they finally started to get their way initially in regards to a war against Spain, which they had wanted for actually a number of years. Now, the Spanish-American War is not very well known in the United States today, and I think it deserves to be better known because it actually has more in common with a lot of our post-World War II wars than it does with the big wars. You know, it's funny, when people think about, this is just my impression anyway, based on talking to people, observing the culture, observing the popular history books that sell and what topics are covered the most, my observation is that when the typical American thinks of war in his or her head, he or she primarily thinks of World War II and the Civil War. That's my impression anyway. And of course, World War II and the Civil War are the two largest total wars this country has ever fought, by most measures. And as such, they are by far the exception, not the norm. And the norm is more along the lines of the war with Spain, or the war against the Filipinos, which we'll cover next time, which follows immediately after the war with Spain. These types of small wars or counterinsurgency wars, things like this, is far more common and far more characteristic of America's wars over the centuries than World War II or the Civil War. Those are abnormal and unusual, and yet that's how most people tend to think of wars, through that lens, and I think it's very misleading. Now, the origins of the Spanish-American War lay in Cuba. By the late 19th century, Spain was a third-rate power at best. It was long past its imperial heyday of the 16th century, and they really didn't have that much of their once sprawling empire left. One of the few places they still had control of was Cuba, and that control was being seriously challenged. Several uprisings of Cuban nationalists occurred during the 19th century, and a new rebellion broke out in 1895. And Americans who favored the large policy immediately started to say that America ought to intervene to help the Cubans get their independence from Spain. Now, of course, they had other motivations, just like neocons today. They had lots of other motivations, and probably spreading freedom to Cuba was not really their primary concern. It was just a wonderful cover and a wonderful PR story. Now, the Spanish responded to this insurgency with some harsh measures. When you start, if you're a government and you try to fight an insurgency, right, a guerrilla war, fighting against guerrillas, it's pretty much inevitable that sooner or later you're going to start fighting the population, the civilian population, because it's the civilian population that allows guerrilla fighters to operate. They give them intelligence, material support, and so on. As Mao Zedong, a guy who knew a thing or two about guerrilla warfare, put it, the civilian population is like water, and the guerrillas are like fish. And as long as the fish have water to swim in, they're fine. They're fine. So, the Spanish general in charge was a guy named Weyler, W-E-Y-L-E-R. And Weyler, by the way, was a self-professed admirer of William Tecumseh Sherman, which I might do a podcast on him at some point. Noted American war criminal, as I would call him. Sherman is most famous for waging total war against the southern civilian population during the latter stages of the Civil War, doing things like destroying food supply, destroying civilian infrastructure, leveling, in some cases, entire cities to the ground, and breaking the South that way rather than through defeating their army on the battlefield. What's less well known about Sherman amongst the average American is that after the war, Sherman was the main guy in charge for many years of putting down the Western Indians, of getting them out of the way of America's westward expansion and railroad building and all that stuff. And that Sherman gave the Indians largely the same treatment he had given Southerners, which is focus on going after their civilian population and reducing the civilian population's will to resist and reducing the civilian population's ability to support any type of resistance on the part of fighters. And so that's what was going on leading up to the 1890s, was that Sherman had been for many years involved in trying to crush the Indians out west. And this Spanish General Weyler was a self-professed admirer of William Tecumseh Sherman, thought Sherman was a great guy and brilliant and so on. And so Weyler rolled out a pretty much identical with a different label strategy to the way that Sherman had dealt with the Indians out west. Out west, of course, you had the whole idea of reservations. The idea that you give the Indians a piece of land, and coincidentally, usually ended up being terrible land that they got. All the good land went to the politically connected railroad corporations. But anyway, Sherman's idea was, it wasn't just his idea, but it was one of his favorite ways of doing things, is to put the Indians on a piece of land and say, you have to stay here, and in particular focus on keeping the non-combatants, the women, children, and elderly people, on a confined place, oftentimes behind such things as barbed wire and gun towers. And by doing that, you cut off all the support for the warriors, the braves who are out there trying to fight the U.S. military. And it really breaks their ability as brave and skillful of fighters as they were. If you don't have any food or supplies or whatever, it's hard to keep up resistance indefinitely. And so General Weyler, the Spanish general in Cuba, thought that was a really brilliant idea. It really had done a lot to break the Indians' ability to resist. So he rolls it out against the Cubans. He calls it Reconcentracion. These are Reconcentracion camps, where the Cuban civilian populations in the areas of Cuba that where there was lots of insurgent activity were rounded up and put behind barbed wire and, you know, in confined camps, where, by the way, conditions were generally terrible, and sanitation was bad, and, you know, inadequate food in a lot of cases. Very similar to a lot of what the Indians went through. And of course, you know, many people suffer and even die in these horrible camps. Now, some powerful politicians in the U.S., including a lot of the guys mentioned in the Large Policy podcast before this, people who wanted America to just get more involved in the world, wanted the U.S. to get involved, wanted to, you know, help kick Spain out of Cuba and so on. But of course, in 1895, Grover Cleveland, who was generally an anti-interventionist president, was still in the White House. This is the latter part of his second term. And Cleveland, as I mentioned previously, resisted calls for war. Even though, by the way, at the time, the United States was suffering through some rough economic times, and probably would have helped Cleveland's popularity to get a war going. That's one of the oldest tricks in the book that leaders have been doing. We know this since ancient times. If there's a lot of discontent at home, economic problems or whatever, it's a great time if you're a leader to pick a fight with some foreign power, and everybody will tend to forget about their domestic problems and their dislike of their government, and instead they'll line up behind that very government to go fight foreigners. And Cleveland, I think, deserves respect and praise for resisting the calls for war, even though it probably would have done a great job distracting from his unpopularity due to economic circumstances at the time. But of course, Cleveland wasn't president for much longer, and in the early 1897, William McKinley, who had won the 1896 election, William McKinley, a Republican from Ohio, he took over the White House, and though he claimed publicly to be against war, he was a Civil War veteran, and he in many of his public speeches and remarks, played on that and said, yeah, I know that war is a bad thing, and so I'm not eager for war, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, though he may not have been gunning for war specifically, he was certainly much more amenable to American expansionism in general than his predecessor Cleveland had been. For example, McKinley restarts America's takeover of Hawaii, which had been sort of put on pause during Cleveland's second term. the people, McKinley himself was not really a member of the large policy clique. He was not as extreme and aggressive as they were. But nonetheless, the large policy guys looked on McKinley as a guy they could work with, or if you want to be more cynical, a sock puppet they could wield to their own purposes. So, for example, Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, arch-imperialist, arch-large policy leader in a lot of ways, in January of 1898, wrote to a friend, quote, "There may be an explosion any day in Cuba, which would settle a great many things," end quote. In other words, he thought something might go down in Cuba that would push the public and the administration the last bit they needed to be pro-war. This is ironic terminology in light of what eventually happens to goad the U.S. into war. There is an explosion in Cuba, which gets things going in the direction Lodge wanted. Now, I'm not here to be conspiratorial on this. The fact that Lodge used the word explosion, I think, is just a coincidence in light of what ends up happening 1 month later, but kind of funny. I don't think that Lodge, you know, knew about some secret conspiracy to blow something up in Cuba. Early in McKinley's term, the Spanish ambassador to the United States had written some letters that badmouthed both President McKinley and the Cuban expatriate community in America that was trying to goad the U.S. into helping Cuba get its independence. They were in places like Tampa and elsewhere, Cuban expatriates sort of being activists to try and get America to intervene into the conflict in Cuba. And somebody got their hands on the Spanish ambassador's letters, turned it over to William Randolph Hearst's newspapers. And remember, Hearst wanted war largely just to sell more papers. And Hearst's papers ran the stories about these letters and claimed that the ambassador, the Spanish ambassador, had personally insulted McKinley's manhood. And if you'll recall what I mentioned last time, there's a heck of a lot of gender and macho-ness and virility and all these sorts of manliness or fear of lack of manliness wrapped up in this whole debate over and over again. You see this. And that upped tensions somewhat, but what really upped the tensions was just 1 month after Henry Cabot Lodge had written to a friend that, hey, there might be an explosion in Cuba, there was an explosion in Cuba. The U.S. battleship Maine was parked in Havana Harbor, and in February of 1898, it blew up, killing 252 American sailors. Now, what actually happened remains still somewhat mysterious to this day. There have been multiple investigations over the years, some of which come to different conclusions. However, the more reputable ones tend to come down on the side that it was some sort of an accident related to the defects in the Maine's design. Naturally, as you would expect, those who wanted war anyway, like Henry Cabot Lodge and Teddy Roosevelt, immediately before any investigation had been done into what happened to the Maine, were saying, oh yeah, the Spanish blew it up, those dastardly SOBs, you know. But that doesn't make a lot of sense, because Spain, during this time period, was trying really hard to prevent America from getting involved in Cuba. Spain was practically bending over backwards to accommodate most reasonable American demands. The last thing they wanted was the United States to decide to get involved. They knew that the United States would, you know, easily beat them in a war, much more powerful, much more modern, you know, navy and so on. Spain had everything to lose and absolutely nothing to gain by sinking the ship. My own feeling, and I'll mention some things in a minute that to back this up, my own feeling based on the research that I've done on this was that the explosion of the Maine was just an accident. Just an accident. However, I will say this. If it was the result of some sort of sabotage or whatever, to me it is far more likely and far more logical that if anybody had deliberately blown up the Maine, it would be the Cuban rebels themselves in order to get the U.S. to take the last step of getting overtly involved in the conflict. Much more likely and much more logical that Cuban rebels would blow up the Maine in order to instigate the U.S. rather than that the Spanish, who desperately wanted to avoid American involvement, would do such a thing. Not only were the pro-war, large policy politicians very quick to say, oh, it was the Spanish, even without evidence. The Hearst newspapers also immediately began running stories and things saying that the Spanish blew up our battleship, we gotta get revenge. Now, at the time of the sinking of the Maine, Teddy Roosevelt was serving as Assistant Secretary for the Navy, and he wanted immediate retaliation long before even all the facts were in. And when McKinley didn't immediately ask for declaration of war after the explosion of the Maine, Teddy Roosevelt accused McKinley of having, his words, the backbone of a chocolate eclair. Yeah. Them's fighting words. Now, a little bit more information about the Maine and what may have really happened and the evidence there. There was a professor at the U.S. Naval Academy at the time whose name was Philip Alger. And he was the United States' leading expert on the subject of naval warship design. And right after the Maine explosion, his opinion was that the explosion of the Maine was almost certainly an accident. And the reason he said this, and the reason he was pretty certain even before all the evidence was in, was that he was familiar with the design of the ship. The Maine had a dumb design. It had the coal bunker right next to the gunpowder magazine. I mean, these are coal-powered ships. This is, you know, not safe like a modern gas or nuclear-powered ship. You got guys shoveling coal into fireboxes and burning that to make the ship go. And imagine you put the place where you're burning coal right next to the place where you're storing gunpowder, right? Now, later, as more information came out, Alger continued to put forth this explanation of what happened when he looked at the nature of the explosion and the type of damage it caused, where the damage was located. Again, the United States' leading expert on the topic of naval ship design said, no, it was an accident because of a stupid layout of the ship. By the way, the Secretary of the Navy at the time, a guy, I forget his first name, his last name was Long, the Secretary of the Navy also agreed with Alger and said, yeah, it was most likely an accident. Naturally, his assistant secretary, the ultra-war hawk Teddy Roosevelt, claimed from day one that he was completely certain the Spanish had done it, that they were behind it. Although we now know today that he made some private remarks and wrote some things in his private personal correspondence, which did not become public for a long time, that indicate that he may have personally had some doubts. In other words, for his own purposes, he decided to just keep publicly insisting that no, the Spanish definitely did it. The U.S. Navy's initial investigation at the time seized on a couple pieces of evidence and concluded that an underwater mine had been responsible for the explosion. Close to 100 years later, the United States conducted another investigation under Admiral Hyman Rickover, and Admiral Hyman Rickover's investigation in the late 20th century determined that the explosion was probably an accidental internal one, just as Professor Alger had said way back at the time. Officially, though, back in the late 19th century when this occurred, the Navy investigation that said, no, it was a mine, they claimed that the captain of the Maine, a guy named Sigsby, was exonerated because the Spanish had attacked the ship. So, in other words, since it wasn't an accident, it was, according to the original investigation, Spanish sabotage or whatever, then Captain Sigsby was off the hook for any sort of responsibility. But what's interesting is, even though the Navy officially exonerated him and said, no, the Spanish did it, Captain Sigsby was immediately transferred to command of a really cruddy ship, an old converted freighter. And so it was almost like he was quietly demoted, even though supposedly he had done nothing wrong to cause the Maine to blow up. Well, maybe the Navy really knew what had happened, that it was some sort of combination of bad design and negligence for safety procedures or what have you. Now, Teddy Roosevelt had used the Navy had used his position as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to ready the country for war, even during the time when McKinley was still not actively decided for war. His boss, the Secretary of the Navy, and I've checked his name, it's John Davis Long, was a guy who had a lot of health problems, and he often was away from D.C. up in a friendlier climate. I think he would go to the mountains in Virginia or someplace like that where the weather was better for his health problems. And so he was often out of the office for long stretches. And of course, if he's out of the office, that means Teddy Roosevelt is in charge, doesn't it? And on one such occasion, when Secretary Long was out, Teddy Roosevelt sent orders to American Commodore Dewey out in the Pacific that in the event of war with Spain, Commodore Dewey was to attack the Philippine Islands off the coast of Asia. So that becomes like the new standing order. If we go to war with Spain, Commodore Dewey, attack Philippines. Now, which true, the Philippines were another of Spain's few remaining imperial possessions, so there is that link, that justification. Nonetheless, if the war is entirely going to be about the United States helping to free Cuba, an attack on the Philippines, which is literally the opposite side of the world, seems kind of strange, right? I mean, if the whole goal is to help the Cubans get their independence, shouldn't that be the centerpiece of our actions? Now, I want to read you some quotes by pro-war people, things they said or wrote in the aftermath of the sinking of the Maine, but prior to the declaration of war. These are people arguing for war based on what happened to the Maine. So first, from Congressman William Seltzer, a New York Democrat, he wrote, "There is nothing the American people despise so much as a weak and impotent foreign policy," end quote. Next, from Senator Richard Kenney, a Democrat from Delaware, quote, "American manhood and American chivalry give back the answer that innocent blood shall be avenged. Starvation and crime shall cease. Cuba shall be free. For such reasons, for such causes, American can and will fight. For such causes and for such reasons, we should have war." Next, from Congressman James R. Mann, an Illinois Republican, quote, "We do not fight for a fancied slight. We do not fight for a commercial wrong. We do not fight for an increase in territory. We do not fight because our commercial spirit has been outraged. We do not fight because our land has been invaded. We fight because it has become necessary to fight if we would uphold our manhood," end quote. You see some patterns developing here? Constant references to manhood, manliness, that sort of thing. American people despise a weak and impotent foreign policy. Have you noticed in that last quote I just read you from Congressman Mann that he says we're not fighting for all the normal reasons a country rationally would fight, like to protect their economic interests, to gain territory, or to defend themselves because we've been attacked first. He's explicitly saying we're not fighting for any of those reasons. We're fighting for our own manliness, right? Next, from a senator with the interesting name of Hernando de Soto Money. I'm not kidding. Hernando de Soto Money, who was a Democrat from, let's see, Mississippi. Yeah, a senator from Mississippi with the name Hernando de Soto Money. I agree. It's hard to believe. He said the following, quote, "Any sort of a war is better than a rotting peace that eats out the core and heart of the manhood of this country. War brings out not the commercial trait, not the business instinct, not the skill to corner articles of general consumption at the cost of character, not shortcuts to wealth, but war brings out all the best traits of character. It teaches us devotion, self-abnegation, courage. It teaches us to offer upon the altar of our country everything dear to us, sons and brothers and fathers and all that goes to make life happy and holy. It teaches us to rise above the petty, the unworthy, the selfish. It broadens our nature, and in my opinion, a wholesome war, like one for human liberty and human life, will have its purgatorial effect upon this nation, and we will come out of it like the phoenix from the ashes, renewed with glory." End quote. Yes. War teaches us all these wonderful moral positive lessons, right? War purifies and renews us, right? Funny thing is, at least all the eras I'm familiar with that we have data for, primarily 20th century, every time there's a war, crime and social problems spike dramatically for like at least half a generation afterward. And usually it starts during the war, if the war is of any significant duration. So this notion that war makes a country more moral is like just literally the opposite of the truth. Alcoholism goes up, child abuse goes up, suicide goes up, mental illness goes up, virtually all types of crime go up during and after a significant war. But, you know, who wants to let facts and the truth get in the way of their craziness and rhetoric and ideology, right? Next, another short one on this theme from Congressman John J. Lentz, a Democrat from Ohio. Our American manhood, the youth of this country, will not rest until that matter has been adjusted to their satisfaction and to the honor of this country, end quote. And, of course, that matter that he was talking about was what happened to the USS Maine. And last is a quote from a congressman named Albert S. Berry, a Democrat from Kentucky. It brings up a theme I might mention later on, which is that this war against Spain somewhat helps to reconcile the North and South, which had only just a few decades earlier been mass murdering each other. And a lot of Southern politicians and soldiers and so on were happy to go fight the Spanish and the Filipinos to prove that they were good Union men again. And so, Congressman Albert Berry of Kentucky said, quote, "We who were defeated in the late unpleasantness," by which he means the Civil War, "will be glad as citizens of a common country to touch elbows with the men of Massachusetts and see who can go farthest for the honor of our country," end quote. Reminds me how, to this day, the South, which was crushed and subjugated by Washington, D.C., is the most gung-ho, jingoistic, patriotic, nationalistic, has been for every single war since the Civil War, and is generally measured to be the single most overrepresented demographic within the United States military, white, working-class Southern boys. Last time I checked, are and have been for most of modern American history the most overrepresented demographic group in the U.S. military. And you would think, maybe, that a part of the country that had been crushed and held into the country against its will would not be gung-ho to then serve that country's military and its imperial ambitions abroad in the future. But in fact, that's just the opposite. You do see a similar pattern in other empires, at least ones I'm familiar with. For example, in the British Empire, there was always a very high representation of Scottish and Irish people in the British military and the British Imperial Civil Service. And, you know, there are all kinds of different theories and explanations of why this is. But it's kind of interesting that, you know, Scottish and Irish people, who were some of the first people to be conquered into the British Empire, would then later be, you know, helping the British Empire conquer brown and black peoples in far corners of the world. It's an unfortunate, horrible, tragic thing. Although, to be fair, in defense of Ireland, they did eventually rise up against the Empire, but the radical Irish nationalist independence movement began as a fairly small minority in Ireland, and lots of Irishmen continued even up through World War I to serve in the British military. Anyway, side note, sorry. These pro-war voices were not the only voices, and there were plenty of Americans saying and writing things against going to war against Spain. Even after the Maine, many American voices were raised against the war, and I think their arguments deserve to be heard as well. So first is a quote from a senator named George F. Hoar. And, yeah, I know what you're thinking. His last name is not spelled Hoar like a prostitute. It's spelled H-O-A-R. Senator Hoar was a Republican senator from Massachusetts and was one of the leading anti-war voices in national politics during the years of the Spanish and Philippine Wars. And in 1898, he said, quote, "The danger is that we are to be transformed from a republic founded on the Declaration of Independence, guided by the councils of Washington, into a vulgar, commonplace empire, founded upon physical force, controlling subject races and vassal states," end quote. Gee, in the over a century since Senator Hoar said that, have we in fact turned into what he warned against? Next, from Senator George L. Wellington, a Republican from Maryland in 1898, quote, "What will we gain by war? Glory? Nay, there can be no glory in defeating a nation than whom we are stronger as 5-1, end quote. In other words, Senator Wellington was saying, we're so much more powerful than Spain, there is absolutely no glory to be gained in beating them in a war. It would be like the biggest, toughest kid in school beating up the smallest, weakest kid. Like, it's not going to give you any glory, any honor. It's just going to make you look like a bully and a dick. An editorial in The Nation magazine, dated April 7, 1898, had the following, quote, "Saying that our honor, in the bellicose sense, requires us to fight Spain is absurd. It is like saying that a brawny pugilist's honor requires him to meet a slight and consumptive youth in the 12-foot ring," end quote. So again, you see this, you can see how these last couple of quotes in particular are also deploying some ideas of manliness and macho-ness and that sort of thing, male honor, but they're deploying it instead of for war, against war. They're saying, hey, there's no honor to be gained in beating up a much weaker country. And a letter to the New York Times, dated February 24th, 1898, said the following, "It is much better to maintain a dignified peace than to rush into a conflict with an arrogant and emasculated race," by which he meant the Spanish, "a race unworthy of a great nation's hostile anger. If the country must have a war, and unless signs fail, it will come sooner or later, let it be a contest with a power equal to our own, and one which it will be an honor to meet in respectable combat, rather than with an effervescent and quixotic race, whom it would be no credit to ourselves to thrash," end quote. So again, same idea, turning macho-ness to say there's no honor in fighting Spain. Though these and other anti-war against Spain voices were raised, ultimately the pro-war faction did get their way this time, in part because William Randolph Hearst's media empire whipped up the public, who normally instinctively tend always towards isolationism, other than when actively propagandized into war. So the media played a key role. And then, of course, the fact that McKinley, while not a gung-ho warmonger like Teddy Roosevelt, was at least amenable to the idea of war. Henry Cabot Lodge, of course, during this time was using all of his pull in the Senate and with the McKinley administration to agitate for war. In the House, Thomas Brackett Reed, who was against war and imperialism, was still the speaker, and while he fought valiantly to do everything he could to halt the drive to war, this time, ultimately, he could not hold back the tide. President McKinley claimed not to want war, but then he insisted on terms to Spain that were very hard for them to meet, although, by the way, Spain tried very hard to meet most of America's terms that we put upon them after the explosion of the Maine. So, for example, McKinley began to ask for Cuban independence, and Spain conceded on most points. They were willing to proclaim an armistice in their fight against the Cuban rebels, and they were prepared to negotiate with the rebels for some sort of an autonomous situation for Cuba. Despite this, McKinley asked Congress for war in April of 1898. And again, despite Thomas Brackett Reed's resistance, the Congress authorized the use of troops and recognized Cuban independence. Now, at the time of the declaration of war, an amendment was passed called the Teller Amendment. And the Teller Amendment stated that the U.S. had no intention of annexing Cuba outright. By the way, this amendment being passed, probably the only thing that prevented that from occurring, given what happened to the Philippines, as we'll see later. Now, the Teller Amendment is interesting, because the Teller Amendment on its face might look like some sort of an anti-imperialist, anti-war victory, but in fact, it was not. The man after whom it's named is Senator Henry Teller, a senator from Colorado. And his motives for trying to protect Cuban independence and prevent America from taking it over were not exactly the most admirable principled positions. So, for starters, $2 million was given to Senator Teller from the Cuban rebel government in exile based in the United States. They literally just gave him $2 million to get this amendment passed saying America won't annex Cuba. The other reason Teller wanted this amendment was that Colorado had a lot of sugar beet farmers, and the reason that matters is if Cuba became an American territory or an American state or whatever, that would put Cuba inside of America's then very high tariff wall. And so Cuban sugar under those circumstances would no longer be subject to the tariff. And of course, that's bad news for Colorado sugar beet farmers. So, you know, the motives for not blatantly taking over Cuba were not exactly the most principled ones. Now, the war went relatively quickly against Spain, and for the most part was a very lopsided victory for the United States. Secretary of State John Hay referred to it as, quote, a splendid little war. It was generally a very lopsided American victory, especially on the naval front. The American Navy won hugely one-sided victories at Manila Bay and Santiago Bay against Spain's fleet. Spain's fleet was obsolete wooden sailboats against modernized American, cutting-edge for the time ships. It was almost shooting fish in a barrel. In fact, there were some reports from American sailors that they almost in a way kind of felt sort of guilty about it being so unfair as they blew up Spain's obsolete, creaky old fleet. In the Philippines, the U.S. Navy, after they destroyed the Spanish fleet at Manila, supported the Filipino rebels. And the Filipino rebels, they had an insurgent rebel movement somewhat analogous to Cuba's that had been kind of off and on resisting Spanish rule for years. And it's the Filipino rebels who actually do most of the legwork in the Philippines on land. And these Filipino rebels believed, for good reason, because America basically told them, that the United States was helping them kick the Spanish out so that they would get their independence, so that the Philippines would be able to govern itself. Commodore Dewey, the American naval commander in the Pacific, even brought in the Filipino rebel leader Emilio Aguinaldo, who had been living in exile. The Spanish had kicked him out of the country because he caused so much trouble. And America brought him back in and dropped him off and basically said, all right, Emilio, go do your thing and get your Filipino guys whipped up against the Spanish and we'll help you. Though they were definitely outclassed in sea warfare because of their obsolete fleet, the Spaniards actually fought rather well on the ground. They even outgunned Americans for a while at some of the battles, such as San Juan Hill. The Spanish Spanish army were generally better trained and better equipped. They had better rifles in many cases and sometimes better machine guns than the Americans, but ultimately they succumbed to superior numbers. The war against Spain only lasted about 4 months, and American casualties were 385 in battle. That was all. But over 5,000 to tropical diseases. So you were close to 20 times more likely to die of disease if you were an American soldier in this war than to die of bullets or bayonets or what have you. Even though on the surface it might look like a huge, overwhelming American victory, the war did expose enormous logistical and organizational problems in the American military. Before the war with Spain, the U.S. Army numbered under 30,000 men. Barely enough to deal with the Indians out west. After the declaration of war, over 200,000 men quickly volunteered, and the U.S. military and government just didn't do a very good job of organizing, training, and equipping these guys. Men very often did not have proper equipment. Many of them had outdated weapons and so on. Even though the standard issue had been for several years before the war, the Krag Jorgensen bolt-action rifle, lots of Americans went into battle carrying the obsolete 1873 Springfield, the so-called trapdoor Springfield, a single-shot 45-70 rifle, which modern bolt-action rifles clearly outclassed. Modern bolt-action rifles already in the 1890s held, you know, at least 5 shots. They were fairly quick to reload with stripper clips. They were much more accurate, longer range than a 45-70 single-shot. And the Spanish had Mauser bolt-action rifles. Their soldiers had those, which were better than the Krag, by, you know, the opinion of most experts. Mausers are better than Krags, but Mausers are astronomically better than single-shot Springfields for modern war. Now, these are not muzzleloaders, these 1873 Springfields that many Americans went into battle with. These are not muzzleloaders, they're breechloaders. You open a mechanism and insert a self-contained cartridge into it, but man, a five-shot bolt-action Mauser that can be reloaded really quickly with a stripper clip beats that every time. It can shoot and hit much further away. Now, when the war broke out, Teddy Roosevelt... I'll give the devil his due on one thing. At least Teddy Roosevelt was not a chicken hawk, like so many modern-day warmongers. Teddy Roosevelt at least had the courage to put his money where his mouth was. And he had been cheering for this war, and when it happened, he quickly resigned his post at the Navy Department and began forming a volunteer cavalry regiment that became known as the Rough Riders. Initially, he was second in command. He made himself the lieutenant colonel of it because he quite, you know, reasonably understood he had no experience in this sort of thing. So he found an experienced guy to be the colonel. He made himself second in command. Funny thing about the Rough Riders, despite their name, most of the time, most of them fought without horses. Teddy Roosevelt was one of the few Rough Riders who actually had a horse during a lot of the operations in Cuba. Most of the horses got left behind in Florida, in Tampa, which was the main staging place for the invasion of Cuba. And as a result, the Rough Riders were really the Rough Walkers. In fact, some of the men in the Union at the time dubbed their unit Wood's Weary Walkers because the colonel in charge was named Wood. Now, Teddy Roosevelt's outfit did see some combat, including the Battle of San Juan Hill and all that stuff. There's some dispute about how much credit they really deserve for winning that battle. There's lots of evidence that some Buffalo soldiers, black units of American troops, actually did more of the tougher work of defeating the Spanish in that battle. What I find more interesting is the evidence you get about Teddy Roosevelt's personality, which I can only describe as kind of psychotic. After seeing a little bit of combat, he wrote a letter to Henry Cabot Lodge, his buddy back home, bragging in very sophomoric terms. He wrote, quote, "Did I tell you I killed a Spaniard with my own hand?" End quote. He claimed that he'd done it with a pistol salvaged from the Maine. Now, whether or not that was true, I'm not sure. In this letter, Teddy Roosevelt bragged that when he shot a Spaniard, quote, "he went down like a jackrabbit," end quote. Now, T.R.'s Spaniard that he shot was actually trying to retreat, trying to get away after the Americans had turned the tide of the battle. Although Teddy Roosevelt insisted that he didn't shoot the man in the back. According to Teddy Roosevelt, the Spaniard was running away, and then he turned around, and that's when Teddy Roosevelt shot him in the chest. Nonetheless, I find it disturbing when you look at how Teddy Roosevelt bragged and talked about this. It's very childish. It's very sophomoric, very narcissistic, very... I don't even know what else to... It's so different. I've never been in combat myself, and I'd rather never be in combat my entire life. You know, if I ever find myself in combat, something severely went wrong. But having talked to people who have been in combat, read a lot of things written by people who have been in combat, watched interviews of people who are combat veterans, you generally find they're not braggadocious about it. Very often you find they're hesitant to talk about it at all. When they do, they certainly don't talk about it in these bragging terms. A lot of times they try to stay vague, and you have to really pull war stories out of them in terms of, you know, killing people and whatever. A lot of times alcohol helps in that regard, I've noticed. But here's Teddy Roosevelt just bragging like a 10-year-old who just shot a toad in his backyard with a BB gun. Now, even at the time, some people were disturbed by Teddy Roosevelt's attitude towards killing this retreating Spaniard, and when he was questioned about his glee over this killing, Teddy Roosevelt responded by saying, quote, "I am not in the least bit sensitive about killing any number of men if there is adequate reason," end quote. After the war, Teddy Roosevelt almost immediately, almost the moment his foot got off the boat, began running for governor of New York, which of course ended up being his stepping stone to the vice presidency and the presidency. Teddy Roosevelt remained a diehard warmonger for life, and he did his best to impart these values to his sons, all of whom served in World War I in some manner. One of his sons, named Archie, during World War I, apparently shot a German and then stomped on the dead German's face until his Archie's boots were soaked in his blood. So, you know, these are the sorts of family values that Teddy Roosevelt passed on. Now, as I mentioned before, Tampa was the main staging point for sending troops to the Caribbean. It was the beginning of Tampa becoming a major town. Henry Plant, who was the main guy owning the railroads along the west coast of Florida, used political connections to make sure that Tampa was used as the main base for sending American troops to the Caribbean. Camp Cuba Libre in Jacksonville on the Atlantic coast of Florida was one of the main training camps. And so this war did a lot to bring a lot of people to Florida. Florida was one of the emptiest states in the Union at the time. For many people, this was their first experience coming to Florida, passing through on their way, being trained or deployed in this war. Legend has it that the cocktail known as the Cuba Libre was invented in Havana in the aftermath of the war. And if you don't know, Cuba Libre is rum and cola and lime. As I mentioned before, one of the side effects of this war was helping to bring the North and South back together, now as partners in imperialism. The North essentially is providing the industry and finance, while the South provides much of the grunts on the ground. Henry Cabot Lodge, for example, explicitly saw the war with Spain as an opportunity to help heal remaining old wounds between North and South. Lodge persuaded the Secretary of War to allow the Massachusetts 6th Infantry, which was en route from Boston to D.C., to stop at Baltimore to march through the city and play Dixie. Now, this unit, the Massachusetts 6th Infantry Regiment, had been attacked in 1861 in the city of Baltimore by a pro-Confederate mob when it marched through the city. So this is very, you know, historical and symbolic. Here's the Massachusetts boys coming through, getting a friendly reception and playing Dixie. After the war with Spain, Henry Cabot Lodge wrote, quote, "The war of 1861 was over at last," end quote. Yes, Northern and Southern white Americans can now team up on conquering brown folks in the Caribbean and the Philippines, I suppose. Some former Confederates even served in the war. For example, there was a general named Joseph Wheeler, known as Fighting Joe, who had been a Confederate officer and now was leading American troops against the Spaniards. And he apparently had some confusion during the Battle of Las Guasimas when the Spaniards began retreating. Apparently Fighting Joe forgot what war he was in, and to encourage his men to pursue the retreating Spaniards, he yelled, "Let's go, boys! We've got the damn Yanks on the run!" Not only did this war bring North and South together, it also helped bring the American government closer to the British, as, of course, the large policy clique, almost Anglophiles to a man, wanted. And Henry Cabot Lodge talked about this. He started talking more and more about the U.S. teaming up with Britain against the rest of the world. And so, for example, after the war, he wrote a letter to John Hay, who at the time was serving as ambassador to Britain, quote, "Race, blood, language, identity of beliefs and aspirations all assert themselves to the drawing together of the English-speaking people all over the world, and of the two great nations seems far more momentous, more fraught with meaning to the future of mankind than the freeing of Cuba or the expulsion of Spain from this hemisphere," end quote. So to Henry Cabot Lodge, even more important than kicking the Spanish government out of Cuba was that the war started to bring America's path more in line with the path of the British Empire. That's interesting. Now, the war with Spain may have been over. It was relatively short, relatively cheap in terms of money and lives, but the war with Spain begets another war, a war that ends up being far more difficult, far more costly, far longer in duration. And that, of course, is going to be the war in the Philippines to prevent Filipinos from getting their independence. And that's what we're going to cover next time.
Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. Check us out at profcj.org. That's profcj.org.